Disruption is one of the defining features of the digital age. From startups to traditional media, everyone in the news game is still busy trying to work out what consumers want and how best to get it to them. Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and this, of course, is Future Tense. Those who are honest admit there are still far more questions than there are answers. Producer Kelly Reardon recently spent time at Oxford University's Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism. And in this edition of Future Tense, she explores issues of content, platform, and trust, seeking out the views of leading news industry professionals and those who consume their product, or choose not to. Kelly Reardon.
I wonder where you're listening to me right now. And more importantly, how did you find me? Did you download the Future Tense podcast? Maybe you searched for media and technology in a search engine. Maybe someone recommended this to you on Facebook. And then what convinced you that you could trust this information? What makes this a credible discussion worthy of your time? All media companies, big and small, young and established, are trying to work out how to get the news to you and how to get you to trust them and to keep coming back for more.
I think the web's tone of voice is different to that, and so we mix news and opinion.
The formulas of news, current affairs, and some forms of documentary, the formulas that were turning people away. They were going looking elsewhere who were not being served.
The credibility that a New York Times or a Guardian have just based on the fact that it's printed in the New York Times or the Guardian in the digital world isn't necessarily enough anymore.
There's no question we're in the middle of a revolution in news delivery. But because we're still in the turmoil stage, there's few answers yet on exactly how news will be reimagined. I decided to take my questions about the future of journalism to some of the very people who are reinventing the news.
As we taxi to the gate on this lovely sunny day here in London, we'd ask you please to remain seated.
This year, I took up a fellowship at the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, based at Oxford University. My goal was to look at how the hallmarks of robust journalism, accuracy, independence, and impartiality, were faring in the digital world. I decided one of my first stops should be the Guardian newspaper in London.
The web has kind of changed everything.
Meet Chris Elliott, a newspaper journo in the traditional sense of the word. He's now the man charged with upholding journalistic standards at The Guardian.
In any one year, we publish about 2,400 corrections now and clarifications. And the web has changed everything because people really want things done much faster.
The Guardian still publishes a daily newspaper in the UK, but Guardian US and Guardian Australia are both digital-only news sites. That is, there's no printed newspaper, just the website. The Guardian was one of the first to pioneer live news blogs, incorporating videos and hyperlinks in a way the newspaper never could. Andrew Sparrow is The Guardian's politics blogger. As a live blogger, he's part wire correspondent, part columnist, and part broadcaster.
And I still see my role as a primary reporting one. I'm there to kind of set out the facts, sort of set out what's happened, explain why it's happened. And I see myself as working in the old tradition of a reporter who sets out the facts.
When blogging began, many traditional reporters were dismissive of it. But now it's often bloggers who break news first.
Readers had a greater level of trust in live blogs than they did in news reports. Blogging is just far more open about its sourcing. The scope for misrepresenting someone is very, very limited because if I quote a speech, I'd be expected to link to the raw material in a way that sort of that level of transparency was never available in newspaper journalism.
So far we've heard quite a lot of talk about credibility and trust in news organisations. But do news consumers, especially younger ones, really think about which news outlets are trustworthy anymore?
I'm Rebecca Wall. I'm a 19-year-old student from UQ. I get most of my news from online sources or on TV.
How do you know which information to trust?
I tend to follow on Twitter a lot of reputable news outlets, and so New York Times, Washington Post, as well as ABC News, CNN. And I guess when I get the same story a few times, I start to get an idea of what's correct and the facts.
What about eyewitness reports? How much sort of emphasis would you place on those?
I find it interesting to look at the tweets coming through, and I think that it is important, but I think it's different to having a journalist there on the ground and getting the facts.
My name's Grant Young. I'm 21 years old. When I wake up in the morning, I look at all the big sites, you know, The Guardian, Sydney Morning Herald, The Australian, the ABC. It's usually online. I look at it on my computer or my tablet.
Do you ever buy a printed newspaper?
No.
What if it's a breaking story, it's a disaster overseas or things like that? How do you work out what information to trust and what not to trust?
Depending where it is, I'll go by reputation, really. Like if it's in the States, I might go to the New York Times. Obviously, social media is where you learn a lot about breaking news, but I wouldn't want to gather my facts from social media. I'd obviously go to proper media, traditional media.
So social media whets the appetite, but sites with reputation still matter. So that's serious news, but I think it's time to talk to someone who doesn't think hard news is the only kind of news.
It's Martin Beelam, and I'm editor of New Formats at Trinity Mirror. So I worked on Us Versus Them and Amped, and I'm just launching a new sports site called Rose Ed. We don't have any formal guidelines, but we always try and do the right thing, and that's the right thing journalistically and the right thing for the web as well. So talking about the mix between news and opinion, which has traditionally had very clear separating lines in print product and I guess in the style of programming that you would do on radio and TV. It's not that I don't think that works on the web, but I think the web's tone of voice is different to that, and so we on Amped and Us Versus Them, we mix news and opinion much more. We don't have kind of like a separate section for opinion.
This is Raqqa, the capital of the world's newest declared state. A state that's been established by a hardline Sunni jihadist group that emerged out of the mayhem of the Syrian civil war.
Vice News is another digital news platform that's changing the way news is presented and delivered. Their lo-fi street view style of documentaries is gaining traction. Many of their videos from Iraq, Syria and North Korea have amassed up to 7 million hits on YouTube.
The workings of the group. But Vice News filmmaker Merian Daria gained exclusive access to their power base in Raqqa.
Despite its popularity, Vice News has been criticised for its subjective approach. Kevin Sutcliffe is the head of programming for Vice News. He says their approach is more suited to 21st century news consumption.
I like passion with journalism, and I think I work with passionate journalists. And I think that they are showing a street view of the world. I think it's involved, it's embedded, it's responsive, it's got an emotional connection between the reporter and the people who are consuming it.
Now, you've got your big media outlets, they've got their official reporters on the ground. But with Vice, it's kind of straight in there, kind of very raw.
I've watched a few of the Vice documentaries, but I tend not to really look at that much.
Vice is going to have an interesting take, and I'd be really interested to see what it is and what they're showing, because it's going to be raw. But at the end of the day, I'm going to take the legacy media as the word.
With Amped and Us Versus Them, both websites which target young people, Martin Beelam says that savvy news consumers understand that content doesn't have to fit a formula or a style anymore.
And how that might work would be that we would do a 200 word piece that might be looking at, I don't know, how some particular government policy has not caused unemployment to fall, or it's a training scheme and it hasn't got anyone into a full-time job. And the first 180 words of the piece will be dead straight about the facts, and then the last sentence will be saying like, oh, well, so that worked well, George, didn't it? There's a kind of like a barb at the Chancellor, which is more of an opinionated thing and comes out of Trinity Mirror or the Mirror's, you know, progressive left-leaning line. So we're quite clear that we have an angle on stories, but we're also really scrupulous about the facts.
Getting the facts right and making sure information is accurate has been one of the greatest challenges of this new era. In the viral news world, where information is circulating at a rapid speed and the media's in a frenzy to get a scoop, there can be a temptation to publish information before it's been checked. A short tube ride across London and I arrive at the BBC's headquarters.
Yeah, so I'm Chris Hamilton and I'm social media editor for BBC News.
Chris presides over a team of journalists whose job it is not just to tell us what's true, but also now to tell us what's not true. The team uses everything from mapping and imaging tools to metadata to work out what's legitimate information to pass on to the audience. Think CSI-style forensics meets old-school fact-checking.
I think the whole thing of running stuff before, you know, just because it's out there, I think that's where I do have more of a problem. And, you know, you do see this. I remember after Bin Laden was killed, a picture of his corpse was doing the rounds. And it was included in coverage just on the basis it was doing the rounds. No one was actually checking whether it was true or not. It was doing the rounds on Twitter, on social media, and it had been picked up and was being slapped on air with, you know, we don't know if this is true, but hey, it's doing the rounds, it looks a bit like him. Certainly for established news organisations, I think that's a fairly serious line to go across.
Police tonight are trying to piece together the details of what was an extraordinarily savage and extreme attack carried out in the middle of the day. They described how a man was attacked with a machete by two others who hacked him to death and then tried to decapitate him.
Chris Elliott of The Guardian says that when a soldier was stabbed in a London street, the paper's blogs producer had a strong system of verifying their information, even though the live blog was being constantly updated.
So Paul Owen, who's our blogs producer, says, during the Woolwich live blog, we contacted many people who were tweeting and spoke directly to them. We would look at their history of tweets or videos and ask if this is the first time they've posted. Some tweets have been geotagged, so you can tell where the tweeter was. We would try to check a photo by looking at Google Maps on Street View to see if the buildings match. There are technical ways of checking whether a photo or video has been posted before. We cross-check information against what we know from reputable sources. None of these things are foolproof, but the key is to be upfront with the reader about what we can and cannot verify. Sometimes we have to say, we cannot verify this, but it does square with what we're hearing from other sources. And I think that's legitimate, and I think the key here is transparency.
Across the Atlantic in the United States, a similar approach has developed at National Public Radio, or NPR as it's known. It's early when I wake up NPR's standards editor, Mark Memmott.
We'll push back and say, how do you know this? Where are you? Can you give us some more information about who you are, how you came to know this? And we'll cross-check that against what officials at the scene are saying, what, when they get there, our reporters at the scene are saying, and what other news outlets who have people there are saying.
NPR is a legacy media organisation, a national radio service well before they delved into digital territory with live news blogs and social media feeds. But what about the digital-only news outlets, where the deadline is not a 24-hourly one, but instead feeds the constant and hungry demands of an online audience, which expects information as it breaks, when facts may not be fully known? I put this question to Gideon Litchfield. He worked for The Economist before joining the digital-only business site Quartz 2 years ago.
We don't have full-time fact-checkers. We have a fairly strong policy on making corrections very clear and very visible. You know, because so much of the kind of reporting that we do, partly because of the pace at which it happens, is work in progress, we will also say, we don't know. Which I think is something that, again, in traditional media is not something you're not quite comfortable with. You sort of have to try to pretend to know everything or just sort of only write about the things that you know about. And I think those are just kind of features of online media, that it's things are much more understood to be fluid and a work in progress because they can be changed and updated.
Now, hang on a minute. I thought the media were never meant to get it wrong. Isn't a journalist's job all about checking facts, doing research, and cross-referencing several sources of information? Well, not quite, it seems. One of the biggest benefits of the digital revolution is that it's opened up the process of journalism, and now ordinary citizens can get in on the act.
I always think one of the things about, I suppose you kind of call it more participatory journalism, because the audience can join in with the kind of like news gathering. If like someone points out that we've made a mistake with the data or the statistics, it's like, be gracious about it and you know, fix it and apologise. And I think that's very, important and very, very authentic for the web. But I also think gives it a different flavour that's more kind of native new media than just kind of putting print articles online in the categories they've always been in. Sometimes, you know, we'll get it wrong. But I think being a younger brand, I think we can get away with that much more easily, because it's kind of easy for us to put our hand up and apologise, and we don't have 85 years of reputation to accidentally throw away.
Does that mean that you wouldn't go to the same lengths to make sure something is accurate? It's easier to sort of say, we'll get it near enough.
I think if we've only ever got it near enough, we're always really clear in the piece that this is a near enough. Again, we kind of did, when the mayor of Sochi before the Winter Olympics said there were no gay people in Sochi, we kind of did a thing where we basically said the population in Sochi is like 28,000. The UK government estimated about 6% of the population were lesbian and gay. That means on the back of an envelope, there's more than no gay people in Sochi. And so you can kind of make the point of the story without, I don't know, you know, flying someone over there to start kind of doing a survey on the street.
Of course, when the media does get something wrong, we should admit that. For legacy news organisations, this used to mean printing a tiny, often quite begrudging, apology and burying it deep inside the newspaper. But the digital era, with its unlimited space and hyperlinking, makes it much easier for journalists to explain what they got wrong and why.
There was basically an article, a very long article, that somebody did about this research scientist who turned out to be transgender during the course of the reporting.
Gideon Litchfield is describing a feature article published by the US culture and sports website Grantland. It was about the inventor of a golf putter. The inventor was a transgender person named Dr. V. And during the research phase of the story, the Grantland journalist outed Dr. V as transgender to her investors. Dr. V subsequently killed herself. After much discussion in the newsroom, Grantland decided to publish the story and were strongly criticised for their handling of the transgender issue.
And the way that the article was written and the way that the transgender issue was handled caused a huge backlash.
But here's the thing. Not only did Grantland issue a lengthy apology, they also outlined all the reasons they felt their story fell short. And then they commissioned an expert on transgender issues to write a critique of the feature article. All these pieces of information were hyperlinked, which allowed the reader in on the process of journalism. This started a whole new discussion online.
You know, of a kind that would not have been possible before the online age, and a kind of discussion about the way that journalists cover transgender people that would not have been possible before the online age. And so, you know, for me, that's on the plus side, the fact that you can have these things where suddenly something becomes really seriously discussed and the internet, you know, changes the way that things are done because there is that ability for feedback.
The Grantland correction is a great example of the media being transparent with its audience. And transparency is this really big buzzword in the journalism world at the moment. But what does it mean? And how does it help the audience understand the news? Enter Aaron Pilhofer. He's pretty much one of the world's most respected thinkers on journalism in the digital age. Until a few months ago, he was working at the New York Times. He's recently taken up a job at The Guardian.
In a situation where people are not reading a single news source front to back, and where it's not always clear to, you know, to me, I often end up on sites reading a story and not even realizing, oh, how did I end up here? You know, it's more important than ever for news organizations that want to be taken seriously and want to be credible to be transparent about their sourcing and transparent about what went into their reporting. And so that was in part why Document Cloud, we felt, was so important, is for news organizations to essentially show their work.
Back at Quartz, Gideon Litchfield agrees that transparency is the new objectivity.
It was certainly different from your average daily paper in the sense that we don't do the neutral point of view, neutral voice type of journalism. We do stuff that is opinionated and has a take. And in that sense, it's similar to The Economist in that something should take a position but make clear its argument for it.
Vice News, the popular lo-fi documentary makers, also proudly claim their subjective approach is a more honest one. Vice boss Shane Smith recently told the BBC's media show that
we definitely approach it from a documentary filmmaking standpoint. You know, we have been accused of being subjective, and I say, yes, we are subjective. I think it's almost impossible to be objective when you're going from New York into sub-Saharan Africa into a conflict and say, well, I'm just going to be completely objective. I don't think that's possible.
But look, there's still many journalists who believe that although the internet makes it easier to be transparent, there's still a role for objectivity. The Washington Post, the BBC, the New York Times, and the ABC here in Australia all maintain a commitment to impartial reporting.
We really haven't moved much away from that sense of strictly impartial news gathering and presentation. I don't know that there's anything inherently about the digital transformation that would necessarily impel us to do that.
That's Philip Corbett, the standards editor at the New York Times.
Opinion is cheap on the web. Everybody's got one. But just straight reporting is a rarer commodity, and it's something that we can bring to our readers.
Opinion might be cheap, as he says, but it's also everywhere you turn online. And is that really such a bad thing? Back in London, I make my way over to King's Cross, where I meet Anna Doble, the online editor for Channel 4 News. They have a number of blogs for their TV presenters. But here's the thing. The UK media regulator Ofcom requires Channel 4 News on TV to be impartial. But no one regulates the internet, so the Channel 4 blogs tend to be full of opinion.
There is really no point writing a blog that goes, on the one hand, Assad's a bit naughty, on the other hand, he is, doing this, that and the other that's positive. It would be silly to try and couch everything in a permanently kind of like weighing scales way. So actually, the point of these specialists who we trust and who we love to hear from, the point is they know more than us. If they know more than us, I want to hear that stuff. And if it comes out in a kind of opinionated sometimes or a passionate way, surely that's good.
And I think you grow audience by being approachable and friendly and interesting and stuff that people want to share. And that's not necessarily by hiving out news and opinion.
Back at the BBC, Chris Hamilton says there's room for legacy organisations to experiment with lighter styles of news on social media platforms.
The BBC BBC's nickname is Auntie. I mean, it's sort of quite sweet in a way, and it sort of reflects the whole sort of legacy, TV in the corner of the room, that, all these programmes that we loved, and that it's kind of the friendly. Well, I feel like the BBC sort of is moving beyond that and really has to move beyond that. It's a bit of a process, and the main thing is you've got to make sure you're doing it for the right audiences. So an audience for the 10 o'clock news, the big nightly TV bulletin, which, is focused on geopolitical slant, the age range is older. You're not going to be doing a feature as part of that based on, sending your best Kim Jong-un photos. But I think where it's appropriate to the right audiences, and I think Facebook is a space for that, I think it's fine as long as it's done while still respecting those core values.
Martin Bealham, who runs Amped and Us vs. Them, wants to really experiment with the blur between news and entertainment.
But, I think with Amped, that's also part of the experiment is when Nigel Farage said that you could get a rush hour train from Charing Cross and not hear anyone speak English, we went down and just got a series of trains and counted the people, and we tried to make it a social media event, so we kind of like started with a selfie at the station and, put some stuff on Instagram, and we kind of made some charts that I was then gradually uploading. And there was a bit where I kind of felt this is the closest we've got so far to tabloid data journalism. It's kind of, again, it's like it's fun and obviously a bit silly, but also makes the point. At the last election, when David Cameron wasn't going to agree to appear on TV election debates, the Mirror sent a man in a chicken suit chasing him around the country, calling him a chicken. But there was a moment when I was on that train thinking, oh God, I've turned into the man in the chicken suit.
What is clear is that, to some extent, the digital natives have one advantage. They're unshackled from decades of history, and they're free to rewrite the rulebook when it comes to the quality of news. Gideon Litchfield from Quartz.
We do have, to some extent, a blank slate to start from, where we basically get the chance to look back and say, right, what is it that's actually important about what we're trying to do? Like, what is the purpose that we're trying to serve? How do people encounter our journalism, and how do they read it, and how do they interpret it? What are the things that give it credibility? And you sort of have to answer all of those questions from scratch.
Anna Doble from Channel 4 News has recently left the organisation to go and work as the digital editor for BBC Newsbeat, a news service for young audiences. She says the goal is to take the historic brand integrity of a corporation such as the BBC, but to give the news a fresher approach, a different voice, and a new delivery platform.
I am positive about the future digitally, and that's largely because in all these chats we've had and the conversations that go on around the digital future, everyone says they just want a clear voice. They want something they can trust. They want to know that there's a source that they can go to and become part of their daily habit and sort of get into their routine. And actually the noise, the blur of information is actually the reason people get intimidated by social media and the digital space. So actually the more ways we can make it easier to consume and to know straight away that's true, that isn't true, or I trust that correspondent, the better. So actually all news brands shouldn't be too fearful of the new zippy new arrivers, because they've got that already and they can just start to build that into their social media approach.
Meanwhile, Martin Bealham says there's no point moaning that the internet has killed quality journalism.
Hasn't journalism always been some parts good, some parts bad? I mean, like famously, the first reports from the Titanic is like no lives lost. And that's kind of like trying to do breaking news when you've only got like a telegraph and printing presses. I think some people who publish stuff on the internet don't have very good journalistic standards, but I think some people who used to publish newspapers didn't have great journalistic standards. I like to think that the projects I work on do.
This isn't the first word on this subject, and it certainly won't be the last. I'm going to be one of those people who keep searching out credible and trustworthy information wherever I might find it, and in all its various forms, whether it's a radio show, a meme, an animated GIF, a chart, a newspaper article, a listicle, a TV program. All the biggest media brains the world over are trying so hard to figure this out. But in the end, I can't help thinking that it's only you who has the answer.
And that report was from journalist and producer Kelly Reardon. Thanks to sound engineer Steve Fieldhouse. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next week, cheers and bye for now.
In part 5 of Love in the 90s,
alternative rock had become boring. It was time for a change, an alternative to alternative. This idea of sampling as a new urban folk music had already been seized upon by Beck.
Green Day, Garbage and Courtney Love are suddenly famous.
It shouldn't have worked. Alternative rock effectively became mainstream.
It affect the music.
Sometimes the music can be the enemy.
Streaming from Into the Music on the RN homepage.